You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Thank you for listening to Greening of the Great Lakes, online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com. Here's more with your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, on the other end of my line from his home just outside of Philadelphia is author Charles Fishman, who has followed his best-selling and award-winning book, The Walmart Effect, with a most compelling and entertaining book about something most of us pretty much take for granted, good old H2O. The book is called The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Charles, I know you have a real busy schedule. You're moving to Mexico with your family. Therefore, I really appreciate you taking the time to do this interview.
Oh, I'm so happy to be with you.
Charles, let's start. I've gotten into your book. I got a pretty decent start on it, and I got to tell you, it's a great read. I really can't put it down. And there's so much we can talk about. But let's begin with your approach to writing about water to begin with. You know, as I read the book, it almost becomes like a biography of water. And after a while, it's like you're reading about somebody in your family, like your favorite uncle or something. I mean, you really anthropomorphize water in the book, and I assume that's what you tried to do.
Well, I so appreciate you saying that without you and I talking in advance. You know, I was a few months into reporting the book. I'm one of these people who does a huge chunk of learning, and then I'll sit and write, and then I'll come back and do another huge chunk of learning and write again or reporting. And actually, I was in Detroit at the airport, and there's this kind of very funny, spectacular, playful fountain in the new Terminal A at the Detroit airport that sends sort of jets of water crisscrossing across a huge black marble expanse, all right at waist level. You can walk up and touch the water. And the water was so playful and so engaging that not only did I sit there and watch the fountain for 20 minutes, but almost no one was able to walk past it. And I took down the designer and creator of the fountain so that I could track those people down. They turned out to be part of a whole chapter in the book in the end. And I came away from that thinking, I want the book to capture that sense of wonder and playfulness and to restore some of the magic about water for people who read it, because otherwise it's going to be a boring book and we don't need another boring book about water. And so I appreciate that you think that the book in part does that. It sort of brings water back to life. We don't even take it for granted. To take it for granted, you have to notice it enough to not notice it. And we don't notice water at all. And it's really an incredible substance. So I appreciate that.
Well, and I've been by that fountain many times, and you're absolutely right. You can't walk by it. You've got to look at it for a while. But as I was reading your description of the fountain in the final chapter, I was reminded almost of like an English romantic poet writing about a waterfall in Germany or something. I mean, you really wax eloquently about that, and it's almost like it was an epiphany for you.
Well, it certainly was that day, and, you know, As you were talking, I'm not a romantic poet, that's for sure. But I also have been to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and I have gone hiking along the rivers that are headed for Lake Superior up there. And you can just sit, even a simple waterfall up in the Upper Peninsula that's, you know, whatever, 30 feet tall, no big deal. You can sit there for 10 minutes just watching the water cascade and play through. And that's a reminder that water is really compelling for us. Water is also incredible stuff. All the water on Earth was delivered here from space. There is no mechanism in geology for creating or destroying new water. Plants take water apart. We in our bodies put water back together when we eat. But the total amount of water is fixed. It's a closed loop. So When you draw yourself a glass of water out of the kitchen sink, or you buy a bottle of Evian, or you water your lawn, you are literally doing those things with water that was created in an intergalactic dust cloud 5 billion years ago and delivered here when the planet was created. And I I think that, you know, the bottled water people are always marketing where it came from. It came from the French Alps or the Italian Alps, or it came from Fiji. It all came from an interstellar dust cloud, and I think cosmic juice is much more interesting even than Fiji water or Evian.
You know, the indestructibility of water is one of your major themes, and another one that struck me. But another one that struck me was, you know, you just talked about Northern Michigan, and I know you've spent a lot of time in the Traverse City area and in the Upper Peninsula, and people go to those places largely because of the water resources that are up there. But one of your other themes is the invisibility of water. So water is both an attraction, but in many ways we don't notice it.
Well, and I think, you know, I think Michigan is a good example of that. Yes, the reason people go up there is water, but they don't think of it in terms of water. They think, I'm going to cross-country ski, I'm going to snowmobile, I'm going to water ski or sail or canoe. And the whole appeal of the outdoors in Michigan, I think most of it would be missing without the lakes and rivers and of course, the big lakes. And so I think it's really, Michigan is kind of struggling in thinking about its economic future. And I think water is a absolutely vital and eminently usable economic development tool, reminding people outside of Michigan how much fun it is to come to Michigan no matter what season. You know what I mean? The water provides entertainment and engagement no matter what season. It's beautiful country. And water is also an economic development tool in terms of science, research, R&D, cutting-edge technology. Most places in the world don't have the water resources that Michigan has. And so the question is, can you all develop and market expertise in how to manage water effectively? So you don't sell water to other communities like Las Vegas or Phoenix or Delhi, India. You sell them expertise in how to manage water and make the water they have go farther. And that's another really vital economic development tool. And there's plenty of expertise in that in Michigan, but I don't think it's being sort of brought together and capitalized on.
And sort of a nice irony about that is that if you do market that expertise and you become a hub, for example, I think like Milwaukee's trying to do, I think you mentioned that in your book, but then if other places are able to manage their water resources better, then that in essence protects the Great Lakes from possible diversion, which we're always worried about, at least over the last 20 years.
Well, absolutely it does. I mean, the goal should be to teach people how to manage the water they've got in their community most effectively. Most places have more than enough water to do what they need to do. They just don't use it well. I take every opportunity I can. You all now have something called the Great Lakes Compact, which is both a federal law and a treaty with Canada. There's no danger that your water is going to be piped to Phoenix or California or Las Vegas. It doesn't make any economic sense, first and foremost, but it's also illegal. There would have to be a dramatic change in federal law that would not be possible to do without you guys knowing about it. So I think the Great Lakes are quite secure. I'm not sure I agree with the absolute, you know, there's almost a paranoia about someone taking water from the Great Lakes and using it somewhere else. But you don't have to worry about it because you all have put in place a treaty that makes it illegal. It's almost illegal for somebody to put water in a water bottle in Detroit and drive to Nashville. It's that strong a ruling. So diversion isn't what you should worry about. You should worry about how can we use water to inspire our own young people, science, research, and tourism. Bring people in to remind them how much fun water is.
I'm talking about water with Charles Fishman, whose new book is just out. It's called The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water. You mentioned the Southwest, and I want to talk about a specific project out there that you include in your book. It's Patricia Mulroy's work in Las Vegas, and I think you refer to it as the Third Straw Project, which sounds like an immense undertaking, but it's an example of what you were talking about. How can people who have limited water, how can they manage their water resources better?
Well, Patricia Mulroy is kind of the water czar for the Las Vegas metropolitan area. Las Vegas gets all its water, 90% of its water, from Lake Mead, which is a single reservoir, the largest reservoir in the continent, 110 miles long. Lake Mead in the last 10 years has fallen dramatically because there's been a – it's not only dry out there in Colorado, New Mexico, Nevada. It's been really dry the last 10 years. They've had a drought. And so the level of the reservoir has fallen dramatically. It fell so dramatically that Las Vegas has two big pipes to draw water out of Lake Mead, and one of those pipes was within a few feet of being overtaken by the dropping lake level.
Well, my conversation about water with Charles Fishman, who wrote The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water, will continue in a moment.
You're listening to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Your host is Dr. Kirk Heinze.
This is MSU Today. Visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com.
Well, I'm talking with Charles Fishman, who has a new book out. It's called The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water. It's published by Simon & Schuster. And for folks who want more information, there's a website. It's called thebigthirst.com, all one word, thebigthirst.com. Charles, we were talking about the situation in Las Vegas and the work that Patricia Mulroy is doing out there in Lake Mead and water levels dropping. Let's pick up that thread.
That, if the pipe had been overtaken, Las Vegas would have had only one pipe into the reservoir, and that's dangerous. You don't want to rely on one pipe. So Patricia Mulroy embarked on this project to build a third intake up under the bottom of the reservoir, like a bathtub drain, so that no matter how low Lake Mead went, Las Vegas could still get some water out. Here's how big that project is. That project is costing $3 per person, not in Las Vegas, but in the entire United States. That project is almost $1 billion for one pipe to secure the water supply for one city. So understanding how water works is really important, and making sure we've got the resources we need is really important, but it's also important to manage community water supplies smartly, because the cost of securing your water, especially if you end up in a crisis, can be incredible. And so, you know, if it's costing $3 per person, that pipe is costing $1,000 per family in Las Vegas over the course of 10 years. That's a lot of money for one water pipe that they hope they never use, right? It's an emergency water pipe. So that's why it's important to think about water.
And that points to another theme in your book, and you make a point that we've moved out of the golden age of water, and we're moving into a decidedly different epoch in terms of managing this wonderful and valuable resource. I mean, where are we moving, and what are we moving from?
We're moving from, as you said, what I call the golden age, when water has been unlimited, safe, and free. Americans never think about whether the water is going to be there when they turn on the tap. Even in periods of drought in the West, in Texas right now, no one's talking about turning off the water or limiting. You know, we're gonna cut back on supplying water to 20 hours a day from 24. No one really worries about the safety of their tap water. It's one of the American character traits that we love to grump about our tap water. But in fact, our tap water is incredibly safe and remarkably consistently safe. With the occasional dramatic exception, tap water is absolutely bulletproof in this country. And no one manages their water use by price. The average water supply bill, the bill for your actual water, is $34 a month in the U.S. per family, a buck a day. That era is over. That's sort of one of the main themes of the book, which is that going forward, there's going to be scarcity, and there's going to be scarcity in all kinds of places that aren't used to it. There's not going to be less water overall, But we've built cities, whole metropolitan areas, in places assuming a certain level of water arriving in a certain way in a certain place, you know, rainfall into our reservoirs. And that climate change and economic development and population growth are shifting all those things. And so I don't think there's going to be dramatic scarcity in a place like Michigan, but in much of the rest of the country and the world, we're entering an era where we're going to have to think about how much water we have available and how we use it. A perfect example, Orange County, Florida, in central Florida, where Orlando is, there's a place that gets 4 feet of rainfall a year, more than enough water falls for every use, yet they have terrible water scarcity problems because they mismanage both the water in the ground and the water that falls from the air. And they have put in place a recycling system. So now all lawn watering, all landscape watering, all outdoor watering of every kind in Central Florida is done with recycled wastewater, purified wastewater. They put that system in place 25 years ago, and the population of Orange County has doubled in that time. And now they supply the same amount of potable water and recycled wastewater for lawn watering. They would have had to double the water supply if they hadn't put this system in place 25 years ago. So that, to me, is kind of what smart water looks like. Let's think ahead. Let's imagine an era when there's going to be water supply problems. How can we use what we've got now to begin to fix that problem?
And you mentioned the term smart water, and one of the things you mentioned in your book is that a lot of corporations, businesses like Coca-Cola, and actually folks we've talked to, Ford Motor Company, are ahead of the curve in terms of the smart water thing. It was kind of nice to hear the Orange County example, because there actually is a municipality that's getting its act together. But a little bit from your perspective on why and how aggressive some of these corporations have been in smart water management.
Coke is a good example. Levi Strauss, IBM, believe it or not, Intel, companies that rely on water. In the last 10 years, have realized that water scarcity presents tremendous risk to them. Computer and computer chip companies use huge volumes of water to make computer chips. A place like Levi Strauss needs water to grow cotton and manufacture jeans and dye them. Coca-Cola's reliance on water, Pepsi's reliance on water is kind of obvious. Every product they make is 95% plus water. And so they have actually plunged in and started trying to do two things: assess the risk and figure out how to secure their own water supply. And at the same time, you immediately start saying, well, we've learned something about how to manage our water better. Maybe we can help other people. So IBM, the chip plant in Vermont, figured out how to use dramatically less water, mostly by simply measuring what they were using and assessing it and reconfiguring how they use the water they already have. IBM executives at headquarters were so impressed with what the water people at that one plant did that there is now an IBM water consulting division. You can hire IBM to help you manage your water use if you're a factory or a university or a community. Coca-Cola is actually running a kind of underground State Department, helping the countries where it wants to manufacture and sell Coca-Cola and soda products, helping those communities find ways of better managing their water, because Coke, A, needs that water, and B, Coke has discovered that as soon as there are water problems in a developing world country, Coke is a target, Pepsi is a target. You guys are the problem. And so they're trying to lay the groundwork for much more sophisticated water management, so they're actually part of the solution rather than being part of the problem. And I'm glad about all that. I think we need to catch up with the companies so the companies don't get too far ahead of us. It's our water, not their water. But I'm glad someone's thinking about how to solve these problems.
Well, you may know this and you may not, but you'll be pleased to know the University of Michigan has an initiative called M Planet Blue. Michigan State University has an initiative called B Spartan Green. Major components of those initiatives, of course, are water use management and the reduction in the use of water. So some of the things that are happening in the private sector are actually making their way into the academies and into the public sector. So there is cause for optimism, but I don't want to diminish your sense of the impact of population and development and climate change on this whole issue of water. you tend to be optimistic, but you're not Pollyannish about this. I mean, we got some big problems we got to deal with.
Well, you're exactly right. Let me say one thing. The University of Michigan ran a water semester this spring. The spring term had as its theme water and water education. And so students from every level, undergraduates and graduate level, and students from every kind of, you know, major concentration, ended up learning about water related to sociology, politics, environmental science. And that was great because we need to light up the generation that's coming out into business and leadership and help them understand how important this is. I'm not Pollyannish at all. Water is killing, just in the world of children, water kills, bad water kills 10 elementary schools full of kids every single day. So that's kind of appalling. We should be ashamed. But we have no choice but to solve water problems. There's no substitute for water for most of the functions that we use it for. So there's a forced optimism. If we can't solve the problems, we're really in serious trouble. And the second reason for my optimism is I have traveled all over the world now. I spent a month in Australia. I spent a month in India. I've been to all kinds of places in the U.S. I've been to Fiji. I've been to Italy. Everywhere people are having serious water problems, the people right at the front lines, the people right, who are experiencing the water problems in the poorest neighborhoods of Delhi and in that incredible high-tech microchip factory of IBM in Burlington, Vermont, all those people have grabbed hold of their own water problems and found ways of solving them themselves, realizing that water problems are not global. They're local. They are happening right where they exist. And only the people who live in those communities ultimately can solve those problems. And so I'm optimistic in part because people are waking up and they're realizing that they can solve their own water problems. And most water problems don't require breakthrough technology. Most water problems that exist now have been solved, have hit somewhere else and been solved. And the solutions require better management, better thinking, but we don't need to reinvent water technology in order to fix water problems. And that's also good news. If all we have to do is change our behavior, that's not easy, but we don't have to remake the entire water economy. We just have to remake our behavior.
Well, Charles, my last comment, and I generally like to leave on an optimistic note, but I mean, you have given me a very optimistic perspective on the future. But as you take those long plane rides to Sydney and other parts of the world, I mean, what keeps you up at night? What worries you the most about as you look to 2050, and we've got 9 billion people or 9.5 billion on the planet? What keeps you awake at night in terms of water?
Well, what worries me is, to be honest, is a place like Atlanta. Atlanta almost ran out of water in 2008. Their drought ended in 2009. It's a perfect example of a place that actually has more than enough water, but very poor, very primitive, very wishful thinking style water management. Then it rained. The drought ended. They came within 80 days of running out of water, a metropolitan area of 5 million people. Here's what they've done since that drought. Absolutely nothing. They've continued to pursue important federal court appeals as they struggle to grab other people's water. And now the city has very quietly slipped back into drought. And the one reservoir on which they rely has drifted back down to where it was when the last drought ended. So what worries me is, when there is a lack of leadership, even when you have seen the problems. Yes, 2 billion more people are going to be born. They're not just going to be thirsty, they're going to be hungry. And food, of course, requires water, too. There's tremendous progress to be made, though, in, you know, farmers waste half the water they use. It's not hard to grow more food with the same amount of water or use less water and grow the same amount of food. We have all that information available. What's frustrating is when places are experiencing water problems and they have the money and the talent to fix them, and yet it rains and then there's no leadership and people just sort of go back to their old habits. And so what I worry most about is water not being on the agenda, water not being taken seriously. You cannot solve the water problems of a place like Atlanta on a crisis basis. You can't truck in enough bottled water. to meet the water needs of a city like Atlanta. There aren't enough trucks, and there isn't enough bottled water in the whole country. And so when they don't take their own problems seriously, that's really bad, because no one else can fix those problems and no one can tackle them for them. And so leadership turns out to be really important.
Well, Charles, you've certainly done your part. I mean, it took you 3 to 4 years to write The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water. Congratulations on the book. It is a wonderful read. It's published by Simon & Schuster. More information is available on a website, thebigthirst.com. I wish you all the best as you move to Mexico, and perhaps sometime up in the Traverse City area we can get together and continue this conversation.
Oh, I would love that. We'll be up there again this summer, and I appreciate such a good conversation today. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, and best wishes.
Thank you.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
To hear Kirk Heinze's Greening of the Great Lakes conversation with Charles Fishman again, please visit mlive.com/environment.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. We'll have more in a moment.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the Michigan State University Alumni Association. And if you're the parent of a Spartan, there's no better gift you can give than a lifetime membership in the largest Spartan organization in the world. Joining the MSUAA family opens the doors to our network of over 500,000 Spartans who'll help you feel right at home wherever you go, who can help connect you with Spartans on the inside, who can help you grow in your career. People who give you special treatment just because you're a Spartan. And an investment in a life membership in the MSU Alumni Association doesn't just add value to your Spartan life. It helps Spartans everywhere build more competitive skill sets and move more quickly in the direction of their dreams. Learn more about an MSUAA life membership online at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The Michigan State University Alumni Association. Your personal network for life.
The University Research Corridor, empowering Michigan.
This is an association of the three research universities in Michigan to really collaborate on a deeper level than we have in the past and highlight for ourselves and for the region and for the nation the strength in technology, innovation, new research, investment that we think is going to help change the Michigan economy.
That's University of Michigan President Mary Sue Coleman.
The mission of the URC is no less than to help transform the Michigan economy and to make this a vibrant place that young people will want to come and stay, that businesses will want to be in, because we are a place where a lot is happening and we have the brain power for the new economy. It's here. It's in Michigan. We just need to tap it.
Visit us online at urcmich.org.
So Michigan is vibrant. Michigan has all these things, and we want to signal that to the entire world.
Visit the University Research Corridor online at urcmich.org.
MSU Ag Bio Research, leading innovation in food, natural resources, and energy.
Well, one of the things we want listeners to know is how connected we are, that we're in a response mode of addressing real life problems in the real world here in Michigan.
Dr. Steve Pepke leads MSU Ag Bio Research.
Well, we're everywhere. We're the face of MSU across the state, in the local communities, with infrastructure and research expertise to address those local problems. MSU Ag Bioresearch is the research engine that undergirds the food and agricultural industry in the state, that undergirds our natural resource usage, recreational usages of sport, fishing, forestry, all of those things. And of course, with the recent interest in renewable energy, we have in a very big way moved into this arena as well.
MSU Ag Bioresearch. In this segment of MSU Today, Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis welcome in their counterparts from Ann Arbor,
University of Michigan President Mary Sue Coleman, and Wolverines Athletic Director David Brandon.
We're really privileged today to have Mary Sue Coleman and Dave Brandon from our colleagues at the University of Michigan. For most days of the year, we're great colleagues. There may be a couple where we are on opposite sides of the field, but it really has been a terrific partnership I've had with Mary Sue for a very, very long time, and I know that the relationship between Mark and Dave has been growing. So it's a pleasure to welcome you, and we thought we'd just talk a bit about innovation and how that affects universities and also athletic programs.
Thanks, Luana. I want to second that fact that you and I have known each other for quite a long time, and I've really valued the partnership that we have, because in this day and age, as the state's trying to reinvent itself, for universities to turn toward innovation, entrepreneurship, all those activities that we've done together through the University Research Corridor, I think is a real plus for the state, but it's really good for us and for changing our culture within the university.
You and I, Mary Sue, have been around probably longer than we want to admit on the radio, but for a land-grant university, we've been involved in the connections, and people think about the agricultural ecosystem and our role, but places like the University of Michigan, University of North Carolina, where you've been, Iowa, New Mexico, they all were engaged in this innovation cycle.
You know, that's really right. And one of the things that I've seen over the last decade, particularly, and it's accelerating, and land-grant universities have always kind of had this feature, but universities like Michigan are really picking it up, and that is to really try to play more in that intersection of the theoretical to the practical. Make sure that discoveries are getting out into the marketplace. Make sure that our students have an opportunity to really engage in entrepreneurship. And one of the things I like so much about the University Research Corridor is that, you know, we and you, along with Wayne State, can really share what we've learned about tech transfer, about doing venture accelerators, about really trying to change that dynamic in the state and diversify the economy. So I think it's the sharing and the open collaboration that has been so beneficial to me. And I think we're coming to the table after you did, but it's fun to see it all evolve together.
When I think about the 150th anniversary of the Morrill Act that we'll celebrate this year, it will have one meeting in terms of access, but it was all this commitment to economic development was very much a part of this land-grant movement. And as I think about the future of the 21st century, what we're talking about is cutting-edge knowledge, and it takes all of us with this now, more not by founding of land, but by spirit of commitment to this innovation cycle and the connections to the community, as Michigan is doing now, Michigan State for, as well, that we can all work together to really try to bend the prosperity curve.
You know, I agree with that, absolutely. And the thing that is so astonishing to me is that this takes hold in the culture of the university. I was really surprised to learn that last year we had more than 5,000 students who participated in some way in some entrepreneurship activity, whether it was a course, whether it was doing something in an accelerator, whether it was our 1,000 Pitches competition. So that I think this culture change is really, it's suffusing the institution across LSNA as well as the places you might expect, business and engineering. And I think it's that strength. And I know that among our student organizations that we've had outreach across institutions as well. So that's kind of exciting to see that all happen.
It is. And I think when we talked about the URC, you know, we really did envision this network of students, faculty, staff, our alums coming together to be able to change Michigan and therefore change the world. And so it's been fun to watch. And we have two athletic directors who now want to play golf together and and compete, but are also interested in changing the world.
Well, I think the one thing you go back to is, you know, whether it be Big Chill the movie or Big Chill the hockey game, you have athletic directors that are viewing things much differently in what role we can play with the public nature of our area of expertise and how we can bring components, whether it be FRIB on our campus or the many great things that you're doing down there. I know both Dave and I are looking on a daily basis. How can we take the public notoriety of our coaches and our student athletes and really put our institutions out to the forefront? And when you can do it collaboratively, it has all that much more power within the state of Michigan. Dave, you agree?
I totally agree, Mark. And we are an economic development engine in and of ourselves. These studies that have been done to show just what the sport of football means when home games are hosted either in Ann Arbor or up in East Lansing, the amount of revenue, the amount of activity that it brings to the retailers, transportation industry, the housing industry, it's an amazing impact. And so we need to continue to build our brands and bring more people to town for more events, and that does our part in terms of the economic health of Michigan.
Mary Sue, I know that you were involved in the in a wave of NCAA athletic reform in your years as a president. And how do you view the current landscape?
Well, you know, I might turn that question back to you, Luana, because you've been more deeply involved recently than I have. But, you know, I realize that this is part of an ongoing process, and that it's a challenge. But I think institutions have to step up and demand the changes. And I was quite encouraged. I wasn't able to attend, but I think you were there in this summit that that the NCAA held this summer for university presidents on some things that need to change within intercollegiate athletics. It's always going to be a challenge for us, but I'm encouraged at least that there's a will to get some things right that perhaps need to be altered. And you and I both talked about this, is that we now have a rule book that is almost unmanageable. And I do believe there needs to be some thoughtful consideration of what the rules are going to be, prioritizing the rules, what are the most important, and so that we can all figure out how we can really comport to what we all want to have happen. Because after all, the NCAA is a membership organization. It is us.
Dave, we have a great group of athletic directors in the Big Ten. 12 of us sit around. We all come from different backgrounds. And one of the comments that you made in the meeting was kind of that comparison between how things operate in intercollegiate athletics versus how they operate in private business. Some of that was specific to maybe some of the negative issues that develop and how the corporate world has changed to address that, and maybe some examples that we in intercollegiate athletics sort of need to look to as we move forward in the future.
Well, Mark, the point that I was making is I was a leader of public companies during the transition, and I would call it pre-Enron to post-Enron, which meant pre-Sarbanes-Oxley to after a lot of regulatory changes took place. And really, Sarbanes-Oxley created a whole new world and a whole new mindset where corporate America began focusing on the most important things and holding people accountable for the most important things, and got rid of a whole bunch of things that were maybe creating a lot of activity but not having a great impact. And the point I was making is I believe that that's exactly where the NCAA is right now. We're spending way too much time chasing down text messages and email messages and phone records and whether you have cream cheese on bagels, when we should be devoting the limited resources we have to those specific areas that are truly the most important and create the most risk in terms of competitive advantage and making sure that collegiate athletics stays the game and the high principled business that we all want to be in.
I also, you know, keep reminding everybody about how this model of intercollegiate athletics is really unique to the United States, where you combine an academic in a serious, we want it to be serious academic experience and opportunity for students, and also students who have enormous talent as a sport. I mean, they are gifted in that way. And so to give them the opportunity to do both, you don't find it anywhere else around the world. It is something that is very precious. And what I am constantly reminded about is it is not the excellence of the play on the field that is most important. It's the fact that we all know when we're watching a game that these are young people who are working on degrees, they are serious students, they're playing their hearts out, and they're doing it for their institution, and we're part of this big family watching it. It's very different from any other country and from professional sports, and it's what makes it so special, and it's what makes the fans so passionate about what's going on the field or the court. And we need to keep it the way it is. We're going to lose something really important if it becomes professionalized.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. In this segment, Michigan State University's president, Luana Simon, and its athletic director, Mark Hollis, are talking with their counterparts from Ann Arbor, Mary Sue Coleman and David Brandon.
I think we're really blessed to have the Big Ten as our conference with such strong principles and values regarding academics and the role of student athletes. They're very, very similar institutions, all academically difficult and all committed to student success.
I certainly agree with that. And, you know, it's interesting, Dave. I mean, from your perspective coming in, you're not quite 2 years now in the job. And even though you were a regent of the university and you knew a lot about it, I think there are things that you've learned about this as well and about the Big Ten.
Well, there's no question. And one of the things that you don't see until you kind of get inside the room is the collegiality and the spirit of cooperation that exists. I was really amazed by that because from outside, all you see are these incredible battles that take place on the court or in the pool or on the field, and there's such a competitive element to it. You don't realize that at the end of the day, we get in a room as athletic directors, and I know you do as presidents, and we try to do the right thing for the student athletes. We try to do the right thing for the various competitions that we hold, and we try to make this a great experience for those young people that come through our institutions. And sadly, some of our fans, I don't know about you, Mark, but I get a lot of advice from people who...
probably get much more advice than you did at your pizza company.
Oh, there's no doubt. I used to think people had strong opinions about pizza, but that was nothing. And some of these people just lose track. They just don't understand. These are 18 to 23-year-old young people who the vast majority of them will never make a living in the sport that they're competing in. They're here because they love the place and they want to display their talents, but they want to get a great education, and that's really what it's all about. And this passion for winning and this intense competition and all the stirring that takes place in the social media and talk radio, in some cases, just causes people to lose their perspective.
It really does. For every negative story out there, there's hundreds of positive stories in intercollegiate athletics. And from bringing a small child to practice that's struggling with brain cancer, and to see our student athletes interact with that child and give hope, and see Arthur Ray on his knees, encouraging her to fight the battle. It's just incredible the experiences that we get exposed to as athletic directors, and you try the best to get that information out to the public to inspire them. I think the things you're doing in Ann Arbor with all of your programs is phenomenal. The impact we have in Southeast Michigan from, us playing a Final Four down there. It's just, we have the ability to bring people together in positive environment. And it's important that we celebrate those and listen to the criticism. And I think we all do. It's just a matter of not letting that criticism control what we believe is the best direction for our student athletes, alums, and university.
If we could just get everybody to listen to the remarks that your quarterback made at the Big Ten luncheon and have them really carefully listen to what he said, the world would be a better place.
That's exactly right. I mean, these are young men, and they are trying their level best. Some days they're going to be great, and some days they maybe not be so great. But, we've got to support them. We just have to. It's what's so good about what we're able to do. But, the other thing that I wanted to say is that I am really pleased about bringing Nebraska into the Big Ten. Here's a institution in a state that they are very passionate about their athletics. And we had an experience with them at the Alamo Bowl a few years ago when Lloyd Carr was still the coach, and as I recall, we lost that game, Dave. But you know what? The Nebraska fans were just the nicest, and it was just a great atmosphere. And so I'm expecting that they, when they come into East Lansing or come into Ann Arbor, and we go out there, that it's going to be a good experience too.
It's one of those crowds where you walk into, they are so educated about the game of football, and they respect both teams that are on the field like no other venue that I've been to. It's remarkable when you walk in. It's you are right, graciousness from the beginning to the end, and yet once you start that game, it's always a very competitive game in Lincoln.
Well, Dave, after you've done 2 years, so you think about doing this for a long time, what changes do you see outside of what we're trying to do right now and recalibrating the collegiate model for athletics as you look forward and guiding Michigan athletics?
Well, from what I've seen in my first closing in on 2 years, I guess, is there's an insatiable appetite for investment in this area. It seems like every meeting I go to is at least a $1 million meeting.
That's right.
But when you look at the sophistication and the things that are required in terms of facility, strength and conditioning support, you know, training equipment, the places that our teams want to go to compete to get better, the way that you have to pay great coaches if you want to, you know, attract them and retain them. It's an area where there is a tremendous amount of investment required if you want to compete at the highest level. And we want leaders and best at Michigan to be more than words of a fight song. We want to be leaders and best in everything that we do. And that's going to require us to mobilize our resources and be good stewards of those resources and make sure that we invest them wisely to create that environment that affords our student athletes the best chance of leaving here with a championship ring. That's what we want. We want them to get a great education and leave here with memories of what it's like to be a champion.
And as a business person, as you look at the marketplace and all of the things that are happening around us right now, it's a crazy time for intercollegiate athletics with the announcements of the day and conferences and other things. One of the questions that presidents have been dealing with is how sustainable is all of this?
Well, I can tell you based on our current status and our trend lines in terms of our projected revenues and the like, the business of big-time college athletics is very healthy. The fan interest is tremendous. There's a lot of energy around not just football, but basketball, hockey, all the things that are those sports that we rely on to generate a lot of revenue. Ticket prices are going up. They're not going down. And for the most part, we see huge opportunities ahead if we continue to run a really clean program that people can be proud of, that our donors want to invest in, and that people will continue to pay reasonable prices to come and see our young people perform. We really believe that the future is bright. We recently added 2 sports at the University of Michigan. We added men's and women's lacrosse. And so we're in a mode where, as opposed to shrinking and pulling in our horns, we're really out there investing and expanding our program for more reach and more opportunities for young people.
One of the other thing I think is really critical here is how I think smart the Big Ten has been as a conference in positioning itself and in sharing revenues. You know, we've done this forever. This is not necessarily the way it goes across the country. And I think we've been really committed as a conference to making sure that people have resources across the conference, because we believe that good competition and within the conference is as important as anything that happens outside the conference. And so I like that strategy and that way that we've done it. And I think in our own sort of micro environments, I'm sure it's happening with you all in East Lansing. You've done some very innovative things about the venues that you've done for your big revenue sports. And of course, a lot of you've made investments that have been extremely important. And I see that happening across the Big Ten. And each of the institutions may be doing it in slightly different way. But I think this is a very healthy conference going forward. And I, like Dave, am very optimistic about the future.
I think we are in a terrific position. And the conference helps enormously with the changes that the NCAA may be going through, and I think it will put a premium on the conference's role, as we have both a big tent for Division I, but still needing to deal with the differences across Division I in size of stadiums, the academic requirements, the whole range of things, and we need to declutter the rule book, so that means that conferences are going to play a stronger and stronger role.
Well, you know, I agree with that, and I'd like to believe that, you know, Dave is absolutely right about the fact that we need to do this with great integrity, great academic integrity. If we lose that, then everything that's good about this whole construct of intercollegiate athletics goes away. And I think, you know, Luana, you and I both know how much the commissioner helps to guide that effort, reminds us all the time about how important it is, how important the behavior, the personal behavior of student athletes is, both on and off the field. And I think we've got the emphasis right where it should be. And I've been very pleased because now I've been associated with the conference. I was just thinking I'm going in on my 17th year as a president, either at Iowa or at Michigan. So I've seen a lot. I've seen a lot of evolution. And that part of it, that's what gives me confidence about the future.
Yeah, it is interesting that our issues, our concerns are the same. They begin with the student and end with the student, as well as then developing a high quality experience for anyone who comes to our campuses, to the best we can, recognizing that we're going to strive for perfection and as often is the case, fall a little short, but we're going to work very hard to make sure that people can be proud of both institutions.
I agree with you, absolutely. And I really view our collaboration. I just wanted to get back to the University Research Corridor a minute because, for me, that's been a very, very important development that you and I have been really pushing over the last few years. And we're doing a lot, but I think we can do a lot more. And I think this is one of those opportunities that the state has to make things happen in the state, but also to give the rest of the country a really good message about the research capacity that we have here in Michigan, which is among the top regions in the nation. And it's something that I think we can really help to change that economic future of the state for the better.
And not only have we weathered the economic storm, but there are instances in both campuses where our leadership internationally continues to grow, and we just need a 24-hour academic station to go with all these people talking about football.
There you go. That would be really good.
But apart from that, we're always proud of winning, but we're just even more proud of the friendships we have with both of you and the way in which you make such a big difference for the state of Michigan. So thanks for being with us.
Thank you. You're most welcome. Thank you.
That was Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis talking with their counterparts from Ann Arbor, University of Michigan President Mary Sue Coleman, and Wolverines Athletic Director David Brandon on MSU Today here on AM 870 WKAR. To hear that conversation again, please visit SpartanPodcast.com.
This is MSU Today with Russ White on AM 870 WKAR.
Visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and tune in every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.